Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 171, Buddhist Advice for Kings, Rulers, and Oligarchs.
Fantastic, this book. It is really, and even some of the things that it says that are so contemporary. And why I picked this text for this year was, which I think is going to be the last year of the Trump administration, I think I picked it because it reflects all the unethicality that not just him, but all the people around him are doing and the destructive stuff they're doing. All these mental things are all these little attitudes and mental carping and the desire to acquire things and hinting. It's praising others' possessions so that one might obtain them. This is very much a monk thing, you know. Monks are just receive gifts from people. So they have a thing called sideways begging. So if you're the monk and at the end of rainy season, by tradition, the lay people will come out with different cloth for monks' robes. And then you'll see a stack of cloth, unless you're the last monk in line or something, or they're running out. And then if you're a human being, as a mendicant, but you might see like number five down their line is the one you like. You don't like the top four. And so then you go, no, I don't need a monk this year, you know, the first one. And then the layman is kind of onto you, and then they go, okay, but wouldn't you like this one? And then, no, I don't need one at all. Well, this one is, when it gets down to the one you get, well, okay, if you insist, you know. But then you have to confess that then I did sideways begging, I did it, I hinted that layperson, I picked out that one. And the real mendicant yogi or yogini does that. There's a famous Tibetan one called Geshe Bang. He's very famous. And I love that guy. And he does things like, he was in a line of monks. They were doing some ritual, and then a layperson came with a huge, big pot of yogurt, a nice, beautiful, like ghee yogurt, you know, rich butter yogurt. And they came and they were putting a scoop in the bowl of each monk as it was coming down the line toward him. And then his mind started worrying, why is he making such a big scoop? That guy's a little skinny guy; doesn't need that much. Like, he'll run out before he gets to me. His mind is all in a rage about wishing the yogurt last to reach him in the line. But then he catches himself, and he turns his bowl over when the guy comes. And the guy says, don't you want yogurt? He says, I already had enough. that's a level which then, that's a reason for being a full-time person. You're guarding the little flickers of the mind because they're all really critical. And the more spectacular one was one where he was visiting a lay person who was a shopkeeper who had a tea shop. And then that keeper had to go out, some child or something had to step out for a minute. And then he was there and he was eyeing some tea. And he saw, and this, oh, that's a really, he smelled it, you know, it's really good. The Lapsang Suchang, oh, I like that one. The tea we're having in the monastery sucks, you know, he has a big bin of it, you know, like, he wouldn't miss a little bit, you know, like. And then he actually reaches over and he picks up a handful of it. And then he catches himself and he grabs his left hand with his right hand. And he runs out the door saying, stop thief, stop thief. And then he confesses right on the spot that he was tempted by the layperson that he robbed the tea. And the layperson, what do you mean you robbed it? He says, well, look. And he goes and shows, I took this much tea, you know. The guy wants to give him, but he won't take it then because he already robbed. That's Geshe Bang. So this is the level. He's showing this to king, right? Because he's showing to the king, like, you know, this is the hard work of what this is. It's dealing with these subtlest turns of the mind. You know, the mindfulness thing that everybody loves so much, that's just the beginning, is to look not judgmentally, like what's there in one's thinking. You know, that's sort of looking at your conceptual aggregate and seeing what you're thinking and then how it triggers your emotional aggregate. So it's very good in that building awareness. But this is the real serious person. They get in there and they're into editing and shaping and diminishing the force of this habit and that habit and reinforcing the positive ones, if you follow me. So there's a matter of inner, it's like an educative process. It's an inner shaping of character, an inner shaping of habits, a deconditioning of old negative habits and a reprogramming of new positive habits. So the Buddha taught the Mahayana even in the Pali texts, 100%. But he didn't press people so much. For example, they asked him, how come you're such a great Buddha? Shariputra once asked him. Buddha asked Shariputra, he says, how come you can't figure out what my ethics are? And Shariputra said, I can't imagine what your ethics are, Shariputra. Why? Shariputra is the high saint, you know, the foremost disciple who attained nirvana in the arhat, you know, individual vehicle or fundamental vehicle way, and therefore he already attained it. He's a great meditator and wise person, and he attained it, and he's just living, he's just like running on momentum, and the minute he dies, he's extinct, because he attained extinction already, in other words. There's two kinds of extinction for those dualistic Buddhists, the extinction with remainder, and the extinction without remainder. That's what they call it. And with remainder means then the body of the person who attained that nirvana and became extinct, but still are running around on momentum. And I remember reading years ago in a Sri Lankan little pamphlet, it's like when you turn off a ceiling fan, you know, they have them in Sri Lanka and Asia, you know, and then it still whirls for a while. You know, there's no more electric current, but it whirls for a while, and then it stops, right, when it runs out of momentum. So that kind of person who's attained nirvana, they're just passing time, because they're already extinct. So Buddha then says, well, actually, the reason I am the way I am, and then he tells hundreds of, or if not thousands, of previous life stories where he was, and he calls himself, I was the Bodhisattva at that time. That's the cardinal thing of the Mahayana, the universal vehicle, is you have to be a bodhisattva, where you're going to save all beings, yourself. And Nagarjuna is telling this to the king, too. You know, kings kind of have an idea of being identifying with their citizens, a good king. And so he's telling their king, you know, you have to deal with all beings. When you can't attain nirvana until everybody does. So you have to bring everybody with you, which the normal escapist person, spiritual person, cannot conceive of that. Totally. In the beginning of the Vimalakirti Sutra, these young men and women from yuppies come from this wealthy city of Vaishali, where he lives, to where the Buddha is in the grove of Amrapali. And they say, listen, they praise Buddha, first of all. He makes a miracle, does a performance art for them. They give him some offerings, and then they respect him and praise him, and then they say, listen, we know about trying to be Buddha. We want to be Buddhahood. We want nirvana. We want Buddhahood. We're going to be Buddhas. But please tell us, what is this thing about making the Buddha land, making the Buddha verse, the Buddha field, meaning make the whole place Buddhahood, all the people, all the whole universe? What is that? We can't quite get that one. Right? And then Buddha gives them a big spiel. Then Sariputra says, how can that be? You know, this is not a Buddha land. And then the Buddha shows him that it is the Buddha land. He's in the perfect place for himself to maximize his approach to actual Buddhahood, which he doesn't even imagine can exist. Shariputra, until he hears the teaching, then he kind of begins to get it. So there's no difference between individual vehicle and universal vehicle. If you're going to save all beings, every single one has to get saved. So it is an individual vehicle, right? But to save themselves, the individual, when they really learn the nature of things, and they realize that they're totally entangled with us, poor Shakyamuni. He was entangled with every single citizen of New York, including DACA registrants and migrants and beggars and everybody. Even thousands of years later, he was entangled with all of them from beginningless time. So until they're free, he's not free. And then, which then makes a mystery. How did he, we say he became a Buddha, and I'm not going to get that right now. But what I'm saying is, according to, so he, Nagarjuna, a lot of this is talking about some people even in India in his time are acting like Buddha didn't teach the Mahayana, and modern scholars totally say that. They say that's a whole new thing, everybody made it up, and they don't respect Asian people. And so they think, well, they're just lying, saying Buddha taught it, because that makes them feel good. And even they're so irrational, their theory, they say the monks were becoming very unpopular about 500 years after Buddha's time, 400 or 500 years after his time. Nobody liked the monks anymore. And so they saw that they were liking all the bhakti Hindu gods who were coming to save you, you know, Krishna dancing with you and Shiva being a yogi with you and all this. And so to compete with them, the Buddhist monks invented the Mahayana and pretended Buddha taught it. That's what the Westerners say. It's that rude. Meanwhile, those Pali texts that they think are the original, they call early Buddhism, they were not written down, a single one of them, for 700 years. They were all kept in memory, although the Indians had awesome memories. By the monks, you know, and somebody else kept the Mahayana texts actually, because they were actually written down, according to their own history of themselves, and they were I personally think they were written down by the merchant classes, who were the ones who did writing. The Brahmins were against writing, because they didn't want anybody else to read their Vedas. They had them all memorized, and with extraordinary. There's been a neuroscientific study of Brahmin, Vedic Brahmin, who still today who do Vedic rituals, and they have hippocampuses, like London taxi drivers, who have memorized all the little alleys and streets of London. They have a huge hippocampus memory. And Vedic chanters have the same kind of thing, but they're not driving taxis. They're driving rituals to make the gods behave, you know. That's what they do. Whereas the merchants who had to write, they wrote, they had to keep records, you know, income, outcome, whatever, expenditure, they wrote everything down. So they likely kept these Mahayana texts. And Buddha asked them not to widely disseminate them for four centuries, he said. All theories as far as Buddhist science goes are hypotheses. None of them completely captures the nature of reality. And therefore, the best one is the one that is most open to that, which is called the dialecticist centrist, who sometimes say, we don't have a view. But their not having a view is a view, of course. They then will admit that, because it's wrong to say, it's nihilistic to say, we don't have any view, because you do have a view, you have a point of view. But their point of view is that there is no definitive point of view, finally, except that. The view that there's no definitive one is the only definitive one. Right, which means open-mindedness is the view, you know, and the most open-minded possible way you can be is the view. Pure negation, in other words, that is right, emptiness, which then leaves you with the illusory, magical, magnificent, infinite relativity. Since there's no place outside the relativity, the four formless realms, deep samadhis, disappearing hideouts of the spiritual person. Are not nirvana, they are not Buddhahood. They are just a relative state that seems like an absolute to the ill-educated person who doesn't have the royal, who is not knowledgeable about the inference of the royal reason of relativity. Because they experience it, it's relative, because they're a relative being. Even then, it's a kind of experience that seems like you and it become absolute. You know it isn't the case. Simultaneously, so it doesn't destroy the world, actually, the relative world. It just helps you get away from suffering and take others away from through bliss, you know, through the bliss of that release. But that release becomes contained in responsible, artful interactivity. is the key thing, that which is Buddhahood, not some aloofness. Buddha is not aloof at all, poor guy. Buddha's you and me. Buddha's all of us. You're forced to be. If you perceive yourself as everything with all of the people in it, then you're perceiving yourself as each one of them. Right? But luckily for them, you see them and their deeper nature where they are bliss. They're made of bliss. Their cells are bliss. There's a bliss energy below the wave particle paradox definable level. There's a bliss energy that we're really made of. It's like light, but it's beyond light, actually, because it's light and dark. You know, remember dark matter and dark energy? It's a combination of light and dark. Clear light means it's a gray. It's a gray translucency. So you see them like that, but you don't ignore seeing them. You're not aloof from seeing them just as they see themselves. And if they're not enlightened, they're not satisfied. And they're anxious, and they're frightened, and they're vulnerable, and they're sensitive, and they're worried. And they want to find a way out. So then that becomes your automatic preoccupation. Because I love Steven Pinker. I love the materialists, don't get me wrong. But they have a wrong idea. Their idea is limited, but as limited as is, I love it. Enlightenment now, he uses enlightenment. The 18th century enlightenment is part of Buddha's enlightenment. He just reached there 23 centuries earlier, that's all. And he had something more than just being afraid of the church. He had something more. He has an inner knowledge as well as outer knowledge, not just observing. You know, they started with their enlightenment by taking God away from the church and saying that God's book was nature and that their material nature, and they would just look at that, and that way they would know the mind of God because he created the nature. So really, what that really was a kind of sneaky pantheism, panentheistic heresy of theirs, mixed with a dose of palliative nihilism. Panentheism is the only sensible thing. The church just tells you, no, this universe is not God. You're not God. You're a sinner, you know. God created you, but he's not you. Nonsense. What did he create everything out of? Himself. Then everything is him. Then Buddhists are cool with that. We're all God. If they would say that, we wouldn't mind. But they don't like that. They get absolute otherness of God. They go on like that. If something was absolutely other, it would be absolutely irrelevant. Okay? So then that's the end of that set. And then here is the most amazing statement. He says to his disciple, the king, he says, if you are unable to rule in accord with the teaching, because the world tends to be opposed to the teaching, then for the sake of the teaching and glory, glory being your own Buddhahood, it makes sense for you to become a monastic. So here, and by that means a renunciant, you know, she's using a Western word, because she thinks of herself as a nun mendicant, but really to become a mendicant is what should be, should say. Not because monastic then brings all the Christian monastic connotations with it, which are not necessarily appropriate. You know, anyway, because sentient beings are unruly. Anyway, so that's really amazing, you know, because the height of collectivism, you know, is where the heavy lies the head that wears the crown and all this kind of thing. The king is the one servant of all the people, so the king cannot drop out, has to be there, you know, has to be in charge. In the authoritarian societies, which the whole planet is afflicted with, not just Western. And so, but here he's saying, yeah, you're doing great stuff as a king, and I really like you because you're doing all the good things I'm urging you to do. My Bernie Sanders advice about this Buddhist socialism you're following, which is great, and you're supporting all the schools and making education the purpose of the society, which is the Buddhist thing, which is great, and you're not doing capital punishment on prisoners, which is great, and even you're going to help people out of the prisons. That's amazing. Did you read the thing about the prisons, all of you? Did you read that and doing homework for this, with the thing I asked you to look at? Anybody? No? It's amazing. Second century of the Common Era, maybe, or maybe first century. He's going on and on about how the king should go and check out the prisoners and learn their life stories and why did they go wrong, and try to rehabilitate them, to think of them as his children, don't execute even murderers, the very worst uncontrollable person, exile or banish them, etc. You know, you have to protect others, of course, you know, and they should be punished in a way, but the punishment should be a rehabilitative, educational thing, not just, you know, revengeful thing. It's amazing. Yeah. I thought I was going to cover that, but maybe it was earlier. But anyway, that's okay. There's only limited time. It's quite, it's really breathtaking. And I agree with that, you know. The problem with capital punishment in a society is, you know, A, it doesn't deter people, really. Because people who kill are just as ready, more or less, if they had the different kind of emotion to kill themselves, you know. So they kind of, like how many of those people go and shoot people and then shoot themselves, you know. So it doesn't really deter, A. And B, it encourages killing because it says, if you're righteous and if you have the power and you have the police and you have the courts and you're the society, then it's fine to kill. It's even the right thing to do. So then other people have their rationalizations about why so-and-so who they want revenge against has no right to live and therefore I should kill. So the subliminal message you're sending is the opposite of what you want to send. Because what you want to send people is don't kill people because it's bad for the killer as well as not to mention the murderee. You know, the murderer and the murderee, it's bad for both of them. And therefore, don't do it. So then he starts in with the king as a monastic, as a renunciant, as a mendicant. You should first become serious about your education, focusing on the pratimoksha, that means individual liberation. And it's a list of rules and resolutions that the mendicant, non-mendicant or monk mendicant, that they read every fortnight. They recite together every fortnight, and then they confess any rule that they've broken. And some of them are just more like etiquette rules. Like there's 18 different rules against slurping, for example. These are onomatopoetic words, you know, and therefore you confess, well, I did go blah, 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 blah. There's like 18 words like that. And that's because in communities, when they go back to have their lunch under the tree or in their monastery later, like residents, then they're all very sensitive because they've been meditating and thinking and so on, and then some guy's slobbering there, and it's really disturbing to everybody else. Have to control their irritation, you know, like this. So then you confess, I'm sorry, I slobbered, you know. And then the only four things is killing a person, any kind of sexual practice, stealing, and taking what is not given to you, and or pretending about your state of enlightenment or awareness, pretending to showing off and pretending that you're more enlightened than you are. That kind of lying, in other words. Those are the four things. Then there's no professing that, then they kick you out. Although not always. So, serious about it. And the vinaya means the discipline of the, it's mostly focused on the monk and nun mendicants, but also it has precepts for the lay people also. And also on becoming learned. Oh, gee whiz, that's great, learned. Then why are they just being trained? They're becoming learned because they're being educated. Darn it. And determining the meaning of what you study. That's an educational process. Then you should eliminate those faults that are cited in the Chudravastuka, which is, there's a version of that in the Pali, Kudaka it's called, and so on. Assiduously learn to recognize them, widely known to be 57 in number. And so these are these very subtle things in the mind, which there's a long list of, and I won't do them in great detail, except to say, you know, it starts with wrath, what he calls wrath, really usually anger. And then rancor is a kind of bitter malice, concealment, and hostility, which I don't think is a good term. I mean, in other words, these lists of 57 mental postures, you could say, are notoriously difficult to translate and to figure out really exactly how they overlap with each other, different kinds of anger, different kinds of lust and greed and cover and miserliness and all these, you know, how to distribute the English words the way that the Sanskrit or Pali words originally or Tibetan words is very, nobody's really settled it yet, you know. But therefore the next bunch of verses, you know, dissimulation, pretension, jealousy, miserliness. He gives, you know, that's another four. And he gives a commentary of each of them from traditional sources. And but then whether the, about the English translation, as I said, is still not settled. Then there's a great thing about how many different kinds of pride there are. I don't know if you noticed those verses. They're really fun. One of the first type of pride is, the first is called pride. It is where one thinks of oneself as even inferior to the inferior. So you can have a pride of being the lowest. You know, like, I'm the worst possible. You know, that's a kind of false pride, they say. You know, I'm the worst of the worst. Equal to the equal or greater than the, and or equal to the inferior. So, you know, it's three branches. We are inferior to, I'm the worst of the worst. Actually, an exaggerated sense of self and a perverse pride, because we think we are somehow special because we are the worst. So, you know, some person can really get into it. It's a kind of pride, you know. And I think that's fun. You could, I think in other translations they call it the pride of humility. You know, a kind of obnoxious Uriah Heep type of humility. You know, like, I'm so humble, you know. Like, I'm more humble than you, you know. You run into people like that. And then there's presumptive pride. And then there's pride beyond pridefulness. Then we can see that kind. Here nowadays we can really see that. And then the five empty aggregates. But you know what the aggregates, does everybody know the aggregates? Or I could call them body-mind processes. Does everybody know that? Well, the thing about the five aggregates is that it's considered the your material processes of your body, right? Then your sensations of pleasure, pain, and numbness, which people wrongly usually translate as feelings, which we in English can be, it's a sensation of pleasure and pain, but usually it's an emotion. But these are just feelings, pleasure, pain, both physical and mental, sort of, and numbness, six types. Neutral, mental, pleasure, or neither pleasure nor pain. Neutral, physical, neither pleasure nor pain. Then physical pleasure, and physical pain, mental pain. And that's what second aggregate it's called. And that's sort of that's the first mental one. And it's like, you know you have your body because you have feeling. You have sensations in your body. Like right now, my foot feels comfortable. It's not pinched in a shoe. But my lots of parts of my body, like my back or something, I'm not thinking about, so it's sort of numb to me. And mentally, I'm happy that I don't have any particular agony at the moment. So I have a mental pleasure at that, etc. So that's the next level. It's where mind connects to the body by sensations of having the body or being the body, okay? Then the next one are concepts, recognition, where you know things as fitting with your concepts and images. And they fit on the things. And so then, okay, I know that's a pillow, this is the floor, that's people, this is whatever. And that's a kind of a whole process. And then there's your emotional reactions to those concepts and sensations. And also your deeper things, like your deep sense of up and down, of direction, of the passage of time. You know, we have these deep inner clocks and things, you know, in our mind. All of those things are called mental functions or mental creations. And that's a big aggregate of things, actually, a big set of processes. And then there's the processes of consciousness. So I think you have to meditate on this right now. I want everyone to know what this is, because so many things are related to this. So meditate for a minute. Go into meditative mode.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is Justin Stone Diaz, and I'm the digital archivist at Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa. I'm Bob's assistant. I'm also your podcast producer. I want to welcome you to this week's episode. I want to start by thanking everyone for the great feedback and support you've given us since we started the Bob Thurman podcast. We've heard your feedback, we're working on sound quality, and we're loosening up the format. We've heard that sometimes the episodes can be a little formal and need to loosen up a little bit. So in light of that feedback and your encouragement, we're mixing it up. Each week, I'll try and take a little time and tell you a little bit of what's going on with Bob beyond the teachings and give you a little context of where the teachings come from and how they fit into the bigger work of Bob Thurman, Tibet House U.S., and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. This week's episode is a part of the Force for Good class series that Bob does annually at Tibet House U.S. in New York City. The Force for Good class series is one of my personal favorites. It's based on the teachings of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the book by the same name by Daniel Goleman, Force for Good. Now, the interesting thing about this class is that it focuses on the Dalai Lama's secular work. The class series is intended for all levels, and attendance at past sessions and past series is not required. To learn about this ongoing series and to watch previews from past sessions, you can visit the Tibet House YouTube channel. You can also watch full archive recordings as a part of the Tibet House US membership archives. Visit Tibet House US to learn more. This episode of the Bob Thurman podcast was brought to you by Omega Institute. Through innovative educational experiences that awaken the best in the human spirit, Omega provides hope and healing for individuals and society. To learn more about their offerings, visit them in Rhinebeck, New York, or visit them online at eomega.org. And as always, the Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part with the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special Dasa tours with geographic expeditions, please visit Tibet House US. Full access to our member archives starts at $2 a month. And trips in 2018 include Bhutan. All proceeds from geographic expedition Dasa tours go to support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. And music for the Bob Thurman podcast is provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now back to Bob in the second half of this week's episode. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll hear from you next week.
When you, as you mentally scan around over your body, you automatically, you, like right now, if I become aware of my knee, I sort of focus on a sensation I might have of the cloth of my pants on my knee, what that feels like on the skin, or the posture of the knee, you know, depending on how I'm sitting, and whether there's a little stress in the way I'm sitting, you know, because we move around a lot, because once we hold any position for a period of time, we feel a little stress in that position. And that's all of that, all of those sensations are the sensation aggregate. So it's a level of process. And it kind of sort of covers your body, and to some extent it's internal in your body too. Like you can feel your tongue on the palate, rub it, or on the teeth, the back of the teeth, you know, or you can have a pain in if you drank something too hot, you can have a pain in the roof of your mouth, or you know what I mean? You can have internal feelings like that. And we could have indigestion, pain in the stomach. So inner and outer surfaces, you can kind of. And then the next level of process is your concepts. Like when I say a pain in the stomach, I have a concept of stomach, a concept of pain, which sort of wraps itself around a sensation and identifies it and then feels its effect on me and so on. But then it keeps organizing everything in terms of fitting with concepts for things that I have. And there's like a cloud of these concepts. And then the minute you look at any one concept in your mind, the many more rise up, even your own thinking. You have channels of thinking in language, in different voices in your mind. You have channels of thinking of imagery, like a photo stream, as we have online. And that's your conceptual recognitional aggregate, we could call it. Recognize, meaning you know things by fitting them into patterns that you have prepared by your language and culture and experience, and you recognize them. That is to say, you put your experiences into these categories to organize what you experience, right? And that's the next aggregate or process, aggregative process, and that's but more subtle, that one, right? Because it involves your thought and so on. And so then, underlying that, you have your emotional reactions to what you are recognizing and what you are sensing, and the processes of your body and around your body as well. And you have all kind of reactions to that. And they also fit in with certain things. They're happening at a certain moment. They continue in a certain way. There's all kind of deep sort of structural concepts that are deep structuring your awareness, even connecting to things like your inner ear balance, your sense of balance, actually. You know, it is said that after Copernicus, people in public squares in European cities had riots, and they attacked people propounding the solar-centric model of the solar system, because the idea of being on a spinning ball made people feel dizzy. It disrupted these deeper structural things that made them feel happy on a flat earth. And they began to feel dizzy and nauseous and so forth. Because cultural things are, and concepts, and deeper structural things in the mind, as Kant in Western thought discovered, and Buddha discovered a bit earlier in Indian thought, they're very profound. They totally shape our experience. So then that's the fourth level, more deeper still. And then the final level is our consciousness itself, which at first we think of as a unitary thing, but then we start looking at it analytically and experientially. You are meditating, so you're looking experientially, analytically, and you realize that if your eyes are closed, you're not having any visual consciousnesses. So your visual consciousness is not aligned with your visual nerves and your visual field at the moment, if your eyes are closed, except for maybe the lid of your eyelids, some reddish, pinkish glow in your eyelids. But you are hearing, so your audio consciousness is focused on your audio nerves and then interpreting and hearing the waves of sound that are coming from me speaking. And, you know, today we don't have sirens in the street, but, you know, you have a hearing field around you. Then closer to home, you have a smell field, olfactory, and then you have a taste field from when you had a snack for dinner, and still some aftertaste or saliva in your mouth and so forth, your tongue sense, and you have that consciousness. And then you have a tactile field where your consciousness is zooming around, attending to your sensations of the surfaces of your body. So that's five different types of consciousness, and you realize that they all are very changeable, just as when you look around, you see different things. So the consciousness that registers these things is also looking around, and you're hearing different things, so that is changing with what you're hearing, etc. So you realize your consciousness is a very fragmented process, actually. And then inside all of them, the sixth consciousness, they say, is the mental consciousness. And that one goes around and aligns itself with one of the five consciousnesses very often, which is why when you're deeply engrossed in looking at something, you sometimes won't hear somebody speaking to you. You're deeply floating away in music. You sometimes won't see someone in front of you, etc. In other words, you can become the mental consciousness when it completely aligns with one of the five sense consciousnesses. It ignores the other ones. You know, it moves around. And then also it can have its own inner field of imaginative vision, the inner theater of imaginative experience, where you can have fantasies and memories and you have environments in there, and sort of like your dream, like the one that's almost like the consciousness that goes into a dream. You know, it's like an inner consciousness. That's the sixth one. And it also is changing with all the thoughts in your mind, with the emotions in your mind, with the sensations in your mind, and with the phenomena that occur materially or physically with your body. So these are the five levels. It's a schematization that you use analytically in meditation to become more self-aware of what your actual realistic life process actually is. And of course, this is really critical in the most important thing that you do with Buddhist learning and Buddhist critical thinking and Buddhist meditating, which is you are looking to verify and the nature of how you identify yourself. So this is sort of the blueprint of your body-mind house, you could say. Although actually the more complex blueprints, interestingly, include the field of your sense objects, like what you see, what you hear, what you smell, taste, touch, you know, farthest away, and closest, and then touch is direct contact. But the objects are also part of your mind, in a way, in the Buddhist view, because they occupy your consciousness, you know, and your consciousness reflecting them, and they go out and they also recognize them, and they discriminate between the object you pick out in the background, and et cetera, you know. Not to mention the more subtle levels where, you know, virtual photons bounce over surfaces and come to your optic nerve and then are organized in your perception by fitting them with a concept that you draw out of your own memory. It's a really complicated thing. And you really, if you even just meditate your five aggregates without necessarily looking for the self right away, you realize you are a buzzing, what William James called a buzzing, blooming confusion. When he tried to find the self, he just all he could find internally was a buzzing, blooming confusion. And he said, well, the closest thing to a self that I get is a feeling of constriction in my throat. Warmth and constriction in my throat, said William James, because he met some Hindus who showed him something about meditating that blew his mind. He became like a great, he was a Harvard guy, but he became a great, and he also had a colleague who translated Buddhist texts. Okay, non-duality has one danger. Your oppressive monarch can say, well, it's all one, and you know, it's all non-dual, so I can just step on you. They'll conquer the other country, and it's all nirvana anyway, so who cares? You know what I'm saying? They can legitimize all kind of negative behavior and negative attitudes on the basis that it's all one. Non-dualism is not monism, because non-dualism means that even the duality is one thing. So therefore, the one thing supports the duality. So therefore, you know, one and many, you can't settle on either one and many. You have to encompass oneness and manyness, both. Do you follow? Like you do. Don't say that's impossible. Right now, I have 10 fingers, but they're all part of my one body. I can't really wiggle them all simultaneously. Well, sometimes I can. But I can't think about them. I think about them separately, right? But they're really all one, because they're one body, one nervous system, right? So there are many ways in which we encompass these supposedly paradoxical things. So therefore, the Mahayana is Buddha's teaching. He gives a great thing about that. And because the Buddha simultaneously taught all of that, then of course they really freak out when we say that the Vajrayana he also taught. And he taught that before beaming down. Mandala is just Starship Enterprise in the Buddhist view. It's like Starship Enterprise. You know, in the Guhya Samaja Mandala, the different 32 deities in the usual version of that, every single one of them, like one of them is Shariputra, one of them is Buddha, one of them is Buddha's wife, one of them is Buddha's mother, one of them is the father, the king. All of the characters in the Buddha's play, the Buddha legend, the Buddha story, are all descended Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who emanated into this tableau and worked out in history this story of a prince who became an enlightened person and dropped out and blah, 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 to inspire the planet, you know. It's the way in which the mandala spaceship breaks the prime directive and interferes with the evolution of the society on the planet by planting people who then set a higher example for people. It's truly sci-fi. And someone like Vimalakirti is really Doctor Who, in case you know who Doctor Who is. If you don't know who Doctor Who is, that's homework to go watch Doctor Who. But unfortunately, try to find it on Netflix or something, because BBC has too many commercials in America. But here is that thing I said. Just the ethical conduct of the Buddha was beyond Shariputra's ken. Why then wouldn't one accept that the greatness of the Buddhas is inconceivable? And the non-arising taught in the universal vehicle and the extinction taught for other Buddhas, that's individual vehicle Buddhas, are both emptiness. Therefore, one should accept that extinction and non-arising are ultimately the same. Emptiness is the majesty of the awakened one. Reflecting thus with reasoning, how could the wise not maintain that what is said in the universal vehicle and the other vehicle are equal? That's very good. And he gives a very good explanation of that. This is we don't need to deal with this. But I wish I could, but we just don't have time. But as I said, the key to becoming a bodhisattva, which anyone can do, is it only becomes logical when you have conquered within your mind the subliminal feeling that this is your only life and you don't have to worry about the future one. And also as well, any kind of feeling you may have in association with any form of theistic religion that, you know, someone else is going to save everybody. Even you have a future life, yes, but then you don't have to really yourself do it, because someone else is going to do it, either Jesus or Krishna or Shiva or somebody. So you have, that's those two things that mean that you're only, all what you do only ripens to you in this life, and then for theistic thing in just one life beyond this by the help of someone else. Those two views you have to overcome, where you have faced the somewhat intimidating prospect, and you begin to feel viscerally that is the case, that you have an endless field of play before you, in interaction endless numbers of other people who are really all your dearest relative, really, and have been many times. They may be strangers now, but they are really long term your dearest relative, so you really have a motive to want to identify with them. So when you begins to creep up on you, overcoming our timidity about such a vista, it's frightening, actually, really. We're frightened, like, what's going to happen to me when I'm 90, you know, or 80, or even if I get there, you know. And imagine what's going to happen to me when I go through death and rebirth, death and rebirth, and death is definitely, by definition, where you lose all control. And if you don't know how to surf the situation of losing all control, if you don't have the generosity of letting yourself go and trusting in the loving energy of the universe, then you should be nervous, you know. But it's only when you have that sense that, okay, what I do now is part of a causal web that goes on forever. And it doesn't mean there isn't an optimal way of being relating to that causal web, which is Buddhahood. But given infinite time, why couldn't you reach the optimal way if there is one? And then they can help you think that through, how there is one. And when we do that, then then it becomes sensible. Okay, yes, I might as well drag everybody else along with me, since they're going to be dragging on me anyway. You follow? And this one I did tell you in an earlier thing, but it's really beautiful. A language teacher will make some students, this is to be underlined, these verses. read from a diagram of the alphabet. That's where you start. You learn the alphabet. Likewise, the Buddha taught the Dharma in accord with his disciples' abilities. The Dharma he taught to some is for the purpose of stopping negativity. To some, it is aimed at the practice of virtue. And to some, he taught one that is based on duality. So this means stopping negativity and the practice of virtue. These are lay people, and the practice of virtue is the first type of novice monk. And also the duality is definitely the bhikshu, the mendicant, who, and actually this verse includes the lay people and the monk and nun, the bhikshu and bhikshuni, the male and female mendicants, who, because they become monks, not because they're freaked out about having a household, but because they're freaked out about the evolutionary situation and they want to be professional, full-time commandos, special ops people dealing with their own inner enemy of ignorance, hatred, and delusion. And the order of mendicants in a society wealthy enough and generous enough to support it is the way of having not to earn a livelihood and to depend on sustenance from others while developing yourself as your one job in life. So it's a really lucky thing. It's considered a super privileged thing. It's not at all a thought of some self-deprivation or something like that. And the word which we translate in English when we talk about Buddhist monks and nuns, even monk and nun is wrong. They're mendicants. They're not monks and nuns. They're mendicant, male and female, mendicants. That means living on alms and being supported by the society. And when they become a full-fledged monk or nun, mendicant, male or female mendicant, they graduate, it's called. So they enter another world, actually. A world that lives above the level of the lay people who only have a little time for self-development and have to make a livelihood and take care of people and do things, etc. Which doesn't mean that that's utterly inferior by any means. It just means they don't have as much time and energy and effort to put into self-transformation and ultimately other transformation. So the monk thing, the mendicant thing is a natural and normal and really important thing. And particularly in Buddha's time, and in, for example, in our time, it's massively important. People who like Buddhism in America, they all think, oh, American Buddhism, no, we're not going to have a bunch of monks like they had over there in Sri Lanka and Thailand and blah, blah, and Tibet. We're not going to do that. We're all going to get married, and we're going to do our Dharma practice in the household, you know. Well, that's all great, but the point is, that's the Protestant ethic, actually. The Protestants are not going to go to some monastery and do illuminated manuscripts and be Hildegard of Bingen or Teresa of Avila or John of the Cross. No way. They are parasites on the hard-working Protestants who are working for a living, you know. No work, no food, you know. So that's why we don't respect them, actually. And even Catholics have a hard time manning or womaning their monasteries, although they have more luck with the females because they're smarter. So they're happy to run away from the oppressive family in which they do all the work. So there are lots more nuns. But the male monks, there's Thomas Merton and then a few people making jam and watching TV in between Vespers. What's interesting is he keeps putting compassion here. This I wanted to discuss. Because compassion is not one of the 6 or 10 transcendent perfections or transcendent virtues. It is not. Wisdom moves on to what's called upaya, which they translate as skillful means, but I translate as art. Because compassion is the mental thing. It's the overflow of bliss, or it's bliss bouncing against suffering, and your own bliss bouncing against suffering, and not being willing to tolerate that suffering, being repelled, you know, not being shared, in other words, by the suffering being, and therefore wanting to share the bliss with that being. But then it doesn't function until it is upaya, it is art. Because when you're cheery, and we know this on an ordinary level, when you're feeling good and cheery and so forth, you're okay, you've counted your blessing, and you're dealing with a tantrum in a child or a pukey thing from a friend or a mate or a brother or sister or aunt or whatever, then you know that it takes that, you have to artfully deal with it. If you just say you shouldn't be freaked out, then they'll get more pissed off and they'll be freaked out. You have to do some sort of a dance with the people. You have to like destroy a kid in a tantrum. Like all you parents will recognize the moment at the cash register when the child is in front of the panel, the huge rack of sweets, which is of course calculated to get the parent to have to buy them, or the kid makes a scene. And so, well, that's one way of being artful, but that's not artful, really, because then they'll get diabetes. So without having to make a freak out scene at the cash register when you're trying to concentrate on your shopping, how to get the kid to calm down. Then you can distract him, you can do something else. You know, that's then art, upaya it's called. Stratagem, you know, you have to do this. So compassion becomes a stratagem is what I'm saying. But so compassion is actually the seventh paramita or transcendent perfection or transcendent virtue, because upaya, art, is the seventh one. So the minute the bodhisattva understands reality fully in the sixth stage, the stage of confrontation, then everything they do from then on is art, because that gives them bliss to understand what reality is, and then they have an art of sharing it.
Hi, okay, my dear friend and assistant has requested me to do a short promo piece, which I'm notoriously bad at doing. And so I have two requests, actually. The first one, which is most timely, is that I am presenting in the vein of the Dalai Lama's teachings and how he has used them himself at Omega on the weekend of the end of the month now, 29, 30, 31, something like that, the Friday through Sunday. So I want to encourage people to join me in Rhinebeck, New York at Omega. Next 2 weeks from now, I'm going to Europe to meet His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, this coming weekend. But the weekend after that, they can find me at Omega, and I'd be delighted to see any of you who are there and who have the time and the resources to be there. And I would like to request you, who may be far away and can't do that, to subscribe to this podcast at bobthurman.com and to tell your friends, and because I'd like to be able to reach more people. Why? Not, I don't want you to be Buddhist. I don't want you to pay money to me. I mean, I need to raise money for my nonprofit to save Tibetan culture, Tibet House and Menla. But I don't need myself. I'm okay. I have a pension, although I'm retiring. And but I do want more people to cheer up and more people to find their bliss, as Joseph Campbell famously said. The reason being, when you find your bliss, you realize how powerful you are and how your thoughts, your words, and your acts, such as voting, have a huge impact on the world. It impacts way out beyond our country, the fact that our country is messed up right now. So please, please, please cheer up. Because when you're cheery, and I'm not telling you who to vote for, and I'm not telling you what to do, you figure it out yourself. And when you're not angry, and when you're not hating anybody, and when you're not afraid of anybody, but you feel really great, you will make the best possible choice, I'm confident. Because you are a brilliant and powerful human individual. Okay? So all the best. Come to Omega, if possible, and subscribe to the podcast, and recruit more subscribers. Okay? All the best.